Hi, and welcome to the McGregor Dementia Support Ministry podcast, a podcast providing relevant resources to those currently walking the dementia journey with their loved ones. Today's podcast is a session that was recorded from our Alzheimer's and Dementia Seminar held here at McGregor Baptist Church on February 18th, 2024. Today's podcast is entitled Financial and Legal Considerations by Certified Elder Law Attorney Lance McKinney.
My name is Lance McKinney. I've been doing this for over 30 years, and it's been such a blessing. People, they call it elder law, but I have clients 18 and up, and the whole thing here is we just try to put together all of the different things that people are faced with. It's not just about doing a document. It's not just about dealing with Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security. We try to put it all together. And so that's what we do. I want to introduce Wes Jacobs, if you'll raise your hand there. Wes is another attorney in my office, and he's been a long-term member of our community here. And so he is equally as versed in all of this that we're covering today. So let's get into the meat and potatoes. Quick roadmap. I'm going to talk about things first while you're alive. Okay, the good stuff, right? And so we'll, what do you want in place either for yourself or for your loved one so that you can minimize cost, maximize flexibility, and just to try to make sure your wishes are carried out. Then we're going to flip over and we're going to deal with what happens. How do we get the money to the right people? And so that's the at-death stuff. And then we'll spend a few minutes talking about how to pay for medical care. What are some of the resources that are available? And what does that mean? Do you have to take action today? Or is there something that you can just know that there's a solution down the road? So that's my goal, quick roadmap. So today, while we're alive, we're going to talk about the different ways that we can empower ourselves and our loved ones to help us. So the medical side, Florida has a rule for us. Florida says that if you did no planning, you did nothing, we still have people who we can let speak for you when you cannot. And so in Florida, we call that a proxy. Other states flip these terms, but the idea is that if you've not appointed somebody, then who gets to act for you with the doctors? What do you think the first person is? Spouse, right? How many times do you hear, well, let's go talk to the spouse, right? And then after the spouse, then it's the majority of adult children. And so maybe that's a good thing. Maybe all of the kids work together and they can bring good consensus. But sometimes they don't all work together, right? And so the committee decision becomes a problem. So that's where if you don't make a plan, Florida's plan may not work for you, right? So, spouse, majority of adult children, parents, now most of the time, you know, they're probably already passed or not in that role, or then we go to the majority of our adult siblings. And if there was disagreement with the kids, you think there's disagreement with your siblings, you know? So, easiest thing in the world is you get to pick who you want, and that's a healthcare surrogate. Okay? And so it's a written document where you name who is going to be there for you. How many people do you pick? As many as you want. Okay? How about more than one? Right? Because we want this plan to be resilient, so let's have more than one person in our list of helpers. So every one of you can get a free healthcare surrogate. They're handed out at almost every facility. Five Wishes is a version that you will have heard of. They are produced by Hope Hospice or Hospice. And these are all viable solutions. Every one of you can name somebody who to make medical decisions if you can't. Okay? Doesn't matter. It can be your best friend. It can be your neighbor. It does not have to be family. And they do not have to be here locally. Now, there's some certain benefit to having someone local, but geography, COVID taught us one thing. Sometimes it's easier to get a hold of the doctor on the phone than it is hanging out in the hospital, okay? So don't think geography is the only factor in that. What do you need? You need two witnesses. And a lot of people, when they do their own forms, they say, hey, Wes and spouse, you be my agents. And then they're your witnesses. And this is the one document where the people you name can't be the witnesses. And so that's where, just be aware, you cannot use a spouse, or you got to have someone, at least one person who's not a spouse or a family member and not your actual agents. They can't be your witnesses. But every one of you can get a free healthcare surrogate and should do that. What about those end-of-life choices? How many people have heard of the Terry Schiavo or Karen, I'm going to forget her name. I was looking at Dawn back there. But anyway, so the end-of-life, when I can't tell the doctors what I want for treatment, when I am so medically compromised, any treatment is just futile. It's not helping. Okay, we think about the coma, we think about the vegetative state, but it can be a lot of other factors. The point is you want to name or describe your wishes, and so the living will is part of that documentation. That's part of the five wishes packet, okay? And so it's freely available. Every hospital has to have a state-approved form that you can pick up for free. Is there any reason any of you shouldn't have one? Come on. The answer is no. Thank you. Thanks for playing. Okay, so how many have gone to a doctor in the last 5 years, you know? Okay, so every time you go to the doctor, they have you sign some statement about HIPAA, Health Information Portability Accountability Act, something like that. And it's a great law. It says the doctor has to give you your medical records. Okay, I mean, in the old days, it used to be, I want a copy of my chart. Well, that's our chart. No. It's your chart, okay? You get the records. You may have to pay something for it, but you get them. It also says they can't give the information out to who? All of the advertisers and stuff. Okay, so great. Sometimes the HIPAA law is used in a way, okay, my wife is in the hospital. She feels poorly. She's competent. She understands. She can decide. But what am I doing? I'm right by her side, and I am that pushy advocate, right? Hey, doc, we're not hearing from you. Hey, where's the lab results? Do you think I annoy some people? You know, they're busy doing other stuff. And so when I start to annoy them, what is possible for them to do? They could say, go away. We won't talk to you. HIPAA, we'll just talk to our competent patient. Okay? Well, she's competent, but she's kind of impaired. She's under the weather, right? So HIPAA, if you have that and you've authorized your trusted people, then they can still be your advocate even when you are competent. Okay? How about this? I'm in the hospital and Medicare says, we're not going to pay that bill, right? And so my wife calls the insurance agent. It's a Part C plan. And they say, oh, we're not talking to you. That's private health information, right? Well, they don't want to talk to anybody because they don't want to resolve the bill, right? So HIPAA releases is a way to help solve those problems. Really easy to put in place. So I recommend everybody to get something like that. Okay. Power of attorney. This is for while all of the property, the assets, income streams. Now remember in Florida, we have a default list if you did zero planning, right? If you do nothing, the state of Florida has a list of who can make decisions for you when you can't. We don't have that in the banks. We don't have that for property. It's probably a good thing, right? Because if my wife or my child could all of a sudden get into all my bank accounts just because, I'm not sure we want to do that. But The point is you need to authorize someone to act. Now, a lot of you will say, well, wait a minute. My wife and I, we're both on the joint bank accounts. That's great. But what about the house that you're jointly on? Well, it takes both of you to act, right? And without a power of attorney, then what we go to is guardianship court. And guardianship court is a solution when a person becomes mentally impaired and can't make their own decisions or act. Except what? It involves lawyers and courts. It's expensive. It's intrusive. Okay? So what's the easiest solution to that? Is I create my own backup plan. I say, hey, if I can't act on about my house or my bank or my IRA, I've named my spouse or my child or my neighbor, whoever it is, to be able to have authority to act. And by doing that, I create a whole system that can help take care of me and advocate for me without having to go through a very expensive and intrusive system of the court system, okay? So everyone here and your loved ones, we want to have with these core documents. How many people in our society do you think have these documents? What would be a guess? You think more people or less? About 30% across our entire nation has done any of this planning. Okay? So what does that mean? You guys are all in the elite already because you're talking about it. You're already thinking about it. Okay? So only 30% actually does something with this. So that's where we want you to be. Now, powers of attorney, there is not really a state-approved form. I mean, there's lots of places. You can get documents on the internet. You can get documents. It used to be we went to Office Depot, right? You know, and we would get our forms. That, the power of attorney is just not a, that's not a good way to implement that. And my suggestion is that you actually deal with a lawyer who deals with these end of aging issues, because you want a power of attorney to do more than just pay bills. I mean, we certainly want to be able to pay bills, right? But we also want to be able to do things like shelter and protect assets and get help from other government resources. And that's kind of a specialized knowledge. And so my suggestion to you is you want a lawyer that can address all of those aspects with powers of attorney, not just, can I pay the bills? That's important, but we want more, okay? So what do I mean by all that? Medicaid planning, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but sometimes we have to move assets. Sometimes we want to reduce death taxes. Right now, man, we are all in a very safe place. When do death taxes kick in? If you're over $12.5 million per person. That's a whopping big number, right? So that's not really the issue of today, but it's still something that we want to empower our family or whoever our trusted people are to deal with these issues. And part of it is medical side, okay? Not making the doctor decision, but how to get access to pay for medical care, okay? What happens if you have a power of attorney from another state? Is it good enough? I mean, we live in the United States, right? Well, the power of attorney is the one document that doesn't translate well from other states. If you have a will from another state, Florida recognizes it. Revocable trust, we'll talk on that, Florida recognizes it. That medical decision making, Florida recognizes the documents done in other states. But powers of attorney, we haven't done a good job of saying, if it was good there, it's good here. So if you have a power of attorney from another state, especially if you own real estate in Florida, you should get a Florida version of the power of attorney, okay? Okay, so to me, the power of attorney is one of the most important documents that you can do for planning. Let me pause. Any questions in those areas? Yes?
You talked about healthcare surrogate. How much liability accrues to the surrogate in a situation where they're the
Right. Great question. So liability in, I said yes for the surgery. Am I going to have to pay the medical bill? The answer is zero liability. Okay. And in fact, in our society, if we identify that we're signing the contract on behalf of somebody, so I sign my name for my wife, Lance Agent, Lance Healthcare Surrogate, then I have disclosed that I'm acting on behalf of somebody, zero liability. Okay? Super important takeaway. Okay?
Does that work for other states? Do you know, like, for power of attorney, if someone's a snowbird, do they need to have a power of attorney in both states?
So if you have a power of attorney document that was done in another state and you own Florida real estate, you really need to get it checked, because that's where the translation issue becomes really a problem, okay? Yes, sir.
The power of attorney versus a durable power of attorney.
Great question. So what does durable mean? You know, it's super, super hardcore, right? So durable basically means it keeps working even when I become mentally incapacitated, which is really the time we want it to work, right? I'm not gonna give you a power of attorney just so you can do it while I'm competent, right? But here's the quirk in Florida law. It used to be that we could write powers of attorney that only worked when I became incapacitated. Now the law, because the banks didn't wanna have to figure it out, and I don't mean that, you know, negatively, but it says when we sign it, it's valid immediately. And as long as it has that word durable in it, then it means it keeps working when I become incapacitated, which is our whole goal, okay? Yep, yes, sir.
The goals of incapacitation, where do we cross the line?
Oh, man, I spend hours in court arguing that very thing. So your question is when do we become incapacitated? And the reality is, both in law and medicine, is that our capacity goes up and down, right? Some days I'm sharper than others. When do I cross the line? And my capacity, think of a kid. When I have a teenager, I'll trust them with, you know, $500 in a little checking account. Would I let them buy a house? No. So the more complex the decisions, we don't think that they're competent. And so that works on the other end. I'm a competent adult, and now I still can do a lot of things, but the more complex it gets, the less capable I am, okay? So that's just trying to recognize that both in medicine and law, there is not a bright line.
Because you find a doctor competent or durable, and your kids may want to take over at some point because you have a bank account or resources. What keeps them out?
Okay, so the heart of your question, what's the practical, right? So the practical is, now remember I just said, as soon as I name my child as an agent on my power of attorney, today they can go down to the bank. I'm competent.
But you said durable, so you have to be...
It still works when I become incapacitated, but it also works today when I'm competent. Okay, and so there is no wait until that it works. It works right now.
But what you have, if you become incapacitated, to then have to take over, or is it not?
Help me with your question again.
If you're doing fine,
right?
Going in for a major surgery, and if I don't come out like I wanted to, and now I'm a little bit foggy, can they take over and make decisions? At what point do I give them that?
Right, so as soon as you, on the power of attorney, as soon as you appoint somebody, now you may keep the documents at home, you know, you may not have handed them out, but if they have them, as soon as you name them, they had authority, okay? You go through surgery, you're not so clear, could they help right now? Yes, they can help right now. Could they do stuff that maybe ultimately you decided I wouldn't have done that? Yes, they can. Now, the principal is always has greater power than the agent. And so if I come out of surgery and I come out of the hospital and I say, why did you do that? Give me back my money. Do whatever. You win. Okay? So you don't lose control when you name somebody. You just give additional authority to someone else. Okay?
You can do things like sell your house.
They could. So are you...
You can get back out if it's gone.
That's true. If they take an action and it's gone, you're bound by it. Okay? So what is the key takeaway from this discussion?
Name the right person.
Name the right person. It is really, that is the hardest part. That's right. And so, you know, and we're going to talk about trusts, but the idea is there is no supervision here. Okay? So we're switching over to the who gets the money. Here's the thing. We're going to do this really quickly because I want to spend a little time on some other resources that you have for paying for medical care. When we die, property, our assets, transfer one of three ways. One, if I am a co-owner on some asset, then that could transfer immediately at death. So the classic is I own the house with my wife, tenants by entirety, okay? Or the bank account. When one of us dies, it automatically goes to the survivor because we both owned it during life. Or the joint bank account, same idea. My wife and I, or my child and I are on the joint bank account. Can they take money out while you're alive? Yes, you've made them an owner, okay? When you die, they're still the owner, right? That's the idea of joint tenancy. Second way is by contract. Every one of you guys, if you have any brokerage account, any bank account, you can name the beneficiary. So banks, they call it POD, pay on death. Brokerage houses, transfer on death. Beneficiary, all the same thing. It says, when I die, pay somebody, right? And how hard is that to happen? Okay, here's the death certificate. It's mine, right? All easy. The third way is if the first two haven't happened, co-ownership or contract, then it's probate. Okay. Now, it's not evil. It just is a process. It just costs money. You have to hire a lawyer, and it goes through it. Lots of good stuff about probate, but it costs money. And so a lot of people say, I want to avoid that expense. And so that's where you start hearing about trusts, living trusts. And the idea there is that's really a contract with yourself that says, I'm in charge, I can change my mind, but when I die, someone else is in charge, and this is the instructions, right? This is who gets the money. So I'm kind of moving quickly through it here because I want to leave some time. Okay, so what if I have if I have three bank accounts? One is just in my name. The second, it says, it's joint with my child. I'm co-owners with my child. And the third, I named beneficiaries on that account. Okay? So the account that is got my son as a co-owner, who gets it? My son. Well, wait a minute, I have three kids. I have three kids, and my will says split it equally. Who gets that account that's joint with my son? My son, okay? Who gets the account that named beneficiaries? According to my will or the beneficiaries? The beneficiaries, okay? Well, what if it just said go to child three? Doesn't matter, that's who gets it, okay? Who gets the account in my name only? According to the will, okay? Because I left instructions, and that's the instructions. Well, okay, Lance, I have a will. Because I have a will, it won't go through probate, right? No. The will is the instructions for the probate judge, right? And so the whole point here is that having a will doesn't avoid probate. It just says, this is who gets it, okay? So that tries to illustrate how those three things work together, okay? And sometimes they work opposite. So you want to have it all coordinated together. Let me pause. Any questions? I know I'm just hitting lightning fast.
My question is, some of us have rather big estates.
Uh-huh.
And we want to give a bunch of it away to grandkids or whatever before we die. Can you do that in a way, I guess taxes are the big thing here. How much does the government give? Can we sell them the house for $1 to do that? Where do we get in trouble with that?
So yes, you can do all of that. No one gets in trouble. But here's you want to know when do we have to change behavior? So, $12.5 million is right now the death taxes, and that means during life or at death. So if you give it away during life, as long as it's under $12.5 million per spouse, no death taxes, no gift taxes. Wait, Lance, I heard about this. It used to be $10,000 a year, right? Now it's $18,000, cost of inflation or whatever. You can give away $18,000 a year, calendar year, to every person in America. I'm ready. Okay? So no taxes. I have a deal for you. You can give me $18,000 and no taxes. Okay? I can do that every year. But we also have the lifetime, they call it the unified credit. But the point is that in addition to the annual gifting, you can give away $12 million. Okay? Lifetime, death time, anytime you want. Okay? Does not matter how you do it either. Right? Doesn't matter if it's by beneficiary, by co-ownership, or by will or trust. Okay? So right now, that's a really big number. In 2026, it drops to $5 to $7 million per person, spouse, okay? That's part of the law that originally created this. It sunsets, so we'll see what happens between now and 2026. Okay, any other questions on that? Yes, ma'am.
We have a bank, our daughter is on her bank account because she's the one who would like to handle finances, but in our will we say, to share it with her brother. And the banker is telling us that she'll have to pay taxes if she gives any money to her brother from that.
Right. So the point is anytime the IRS says, anytime I give money to anybody but a spouse, that is a taxable thing. But they say, we'll ignore the first $18,000 per calendar year. And in addition, she has this big lifetime credit, okay? So, yes, assuming your daughter shares as you told her to do, because she doesn't have to, not trying to impugn anything, but the point is that that's unless the numbers are really big, it's not really gonna be a problem, okay? Now, I will. One of the things, I say that, but remember, so anybody who has a traditional IRA, 401, all of these deferred retirement accounts, or annuities where we put the money in and now what? It's just grown some income. So that, when you pull it out, do you have to report income?
Right.
Okay, well, when it's inherited by somebody, when they pull it out, they're gonna have to declare income. And it's not because of the inheritance, it's because what you gave them. You gave them a tax bomb. Okay, now I'll take that tax bomb because I'm still getting something. But the point is not because of inheritance, it's just because someone's gonna report the income on that, okay? Okay, anything else? Well, yes, ma'am.
Could you quickly go over those three scenarios, who got the money into those places that you said?
Right.
No one's name.
Okay, so co-ownership goes first. So the bank account that was joint with my son immediately went to them, no matter any other instructions. The bank account that is beneficiaries, it immediately goes at death to whoever I gave by contract, okay? And then what's left in the pot to be distributed is anything that's just in my name, and that goes through probate, okay? And the will, is the instructions on who gets it from there. Okay, yes, sir.
Would it make sense for the person that's now on a fixed income to liquidate those tax bombs so that the tax rate wouldn't be to that of who's making the higher?
So financial planning, if you have an elder, a loved one that has deferred tax, deferred income, trying to convert that to, because, you know, my mom, her tax rate is, I mean, she doesn't work, right? So that's cheaper to have her report and pay the taxes than when my sister and her and myself inherit. So that's part of good financial planning. Yep, I would encourage that. I'm sorry, we're really getting in the weeds. But no, that's great. But if my mom, here I'll use my example, my mom lives in an assisted living, and that's a medical expense, right? And so that's 60 grand a year. So if I match that medical expense with pulling money out of like IRAs, no one's paying taxes. Win for everybody. Well, maybe not the U.S. government, but win for my family, okay? So, yes, that's good planning. Okay, there are two. We're down to 15 minutes. Yes, sir.
About cars, boats,
sure.
Other items. Can you sign as the seller on the title, and that never has to be any document other than, say, one of your kids could go ahead and sign as the buyer, and this is a transaction that never has to be talked about in probate or not? I mean, let's say you had a trust.
So in Florida, this is not vehicles registered in another state. This is a Florida law, okay? The Florida law allows the transfer of any car, boat, includes planes because they have titles, okay?
Value of that.
That's right. Yeah, so this is not about dollar value. So this works for the Lamborghini just as much as anything else. The key is that you can change ownership after death without probate. Now, if there's an open probate, then it goes through that. But if there's no probate open, then so my wife dies, the car's in her name, I can go down to the tax collector and say, here's a copy of the will, I'm the spouse, there's a couple of reasons, I get the car, and they will charge me $100 to change the title, and I can do it without getting the courts or anybody involved, okay? What I'll caution people on is this concept of, I'm gonna sign the deed or the car title or something, but I'm gonna keep it, okay? And they'll come get it when I die. Because the idea of a gift or a transfer has two components. One, I do the action, right? And the second is I deliver it. And so if it's not delivered, it's not a completed gift. Now, no one's watching cars. That's not the cars, the boats, those types of things. Okay?
This is a friend that said, an attorney said this was okay, but it was in another state than Florida.
Well, and cars, you know, boats, airplanes, that works.
Okay.
It does work, absolutely. Okay, so let's talk, if I get sick, if you have a loved one who is sick, spouse, parent, what are the options or things to help pay for it? And so there are two, I want one fast here. For long-term care, how do we pay for anything? First, you know, private pay. We pay out of our own pocket. And that is part of the process, just like any other expense we have in life. We can hedge that bet if we bought long-term care insurance. Remember I said 30% of America does any planning? Even fewer pay for long-term care insurance, okay? I think it's a great thing to consider. But sometimes people, you know, once you hit over 70, there's medical underwriting in a big way. It gets really cost prohibitive. So that's something that would have to be done early on. Besides those, there are a couple of places we look for extra help. One is if the sick person is a wartime vet. Okay, that has special meaning, and it means someone who served during a defined wartime period, do not have to see combat, or a vet who has got service-connected disability. And so if I served in the military and I was not in a wartime, you know, but when I was driving around and during my service, I flipped the Jeep and now I'm, 50% disabled. That's a service-connected. It happened while I was in the military serving, okay? Those are two categories where the person can get help paying for long-term care. Assisted living, nursing home, okay? The service-connected vet, you gotta be 70% or more before you're a priority help through the Veteran Administration, okay? So if you have a parent who served has service-connected disability, then that's one way to help pay for that. Wartime vet or the surviving spouse of a wartime vet. And then Medicaid. Now the key about Medicaid, to describe what this is, it is a welfare system, which just means that they have a test before they'll give the help, okay? And so long-term nursing home Medicaid that is a complete financial solution for the cost of the nursing home. How much does a nursing home cost? 16 grand a month, easy, in our community, okay? What about assisted living? 6,000, 7,000 a month, somewhere in there, is even higher, yep. I'm slow to keep up with the times here. So the point is that Medicaid will make it possible to deal with the cost of a skilled nursing. It does not help as much for the assisted living. It's only about $1,200, $1,400 a month. So I like to say it's better than a poke in the eye, but man, it's not getting it done, okay? So just so you know what it helps. It was interesting, to be a wartime vet, there's a defined list, and they still have all of the wars from history, which included the Mexican War. Guess what? There's no one still alive, so I'm not sure why we're still talking about that. And in fact, because I started looking at that, the last survivor of World War I was Florence Green, and she died in 2012. And there's only about 120,000 vets from World War II. What is interesting is all the vets from the Gulf War on, which is still open as an open war. And that's 7.8 million people. That's a lot of people. The state of Florida is 22 million people. So that's a lot of people. Yes, sir?
I'm a wartime vet, and I have long-term retirement insurance. What do you mean by health and pain?
We'll go right there. Okay, so what the help, I think I put it in this slide. Okay, so for a wartime vet, because there's two categories of VA help. There's the service-connected, and if you're high enough in disability rating, then it'll pay for either the veteran facility or a contracted facility. So it could pay the $16,000 a month for the nursing home, okay? For the wartime vet, no disability, you gotta be 65. It's odd that they define 65 as a disability, but anyway, surviving spouse of a wartime vet can get $1,478 a month in medical help, cash to pay for medical, okay? For a vet with a spouse, it's $2,727 a month, okay? So what does that mean practically? I am a wartime vet, and I can't live at home anymore. I'm going to the assisted living. Well, the assisted living is $6,000 a month, okay? I have Social Security of $3,000 a month, okay? So I'm short, right? So now I take the $6,000 minus three, my income, I'm short $3,000. Well, I can get up to $2,727 from the VA to help pay for that assisted living. Now, it has financial tests. I can't be Bill Gates and get the help, okay? It's about $150,000 in assets, ignoring the house, because this is the welfare portion of the VA system, okay?
So you're still better off having long-term care insurance.
Long-term care gives you many more options, okay? Not only does it pay for it, but it gives you greater selection of where, in-home. I can bring in-home care, okay? I'd prefer that. So, yes. Okay, so there is a three-year look back. In the past, we used to be able to give away the money and qualify for the veterans' help, but there's a three-year look back. It's kind of hard to get around, but it is a very valuable resource if someone is going to an assisted living or in-home care. It really doesn't pay enough to make the solution for a skilled nursing, okay? But it's a, if you have a wartime vet or a spouse, that's super helpful. What is the number one thing you should all have if you have a parent that's a wartime vet? Get their DD-214, their discharge papers, okay? Because that is gonna be required to apply for any of this. Yes, ma'am? Right, so there was this unique designation for the Vietnam War that you had a wider window if you were serving in Vietnam, okay? If I was in the military during the period, but I stayed in the United States, I never went to Vietnam. I'm still in wartime period, but my window is smaller. So if he was in Germany, then he's judged by the window, the not in country window. Okay.
Are you saying that I would be entitled to benefits?
You, as a surviving spouse, you can claim benefits because of his wartime service.
Thank you for that.
Yep. Okay.
Not that I'm ever gonna use it.
Well, okay, so Medicaid, here's the final thing here I want to leave you with. Medicaid is a governmental benefit that if you fit the criteria, then they will help pay certain medical expenses. I told you that it's a great solution for skilled nursing, not so helpful financially for assisted living, but it's available. They have three tests. You got to be sick enough. How many of us are gonna move into skilled nursing just for the fun of it, right? You gotta have income below a certain level. Right now that test is $2,829 a month. That's gross income. That's the person going in the skilled nursing, the nursing home facility, not the spouse. And so the key is if you have over that income, good, count your blessings. There's always a way to fix that. So even if you miss the test, we can fix it and you can qualify. The third part of this test, sick enough, income below a certain level, and then the assets. The assets, the sick person can only have $2,000. That's a really low number. But there's a lot of exclusions, okay? And so there's just books and books on rules on how we can fall within the rules, legally, fully disclosed. The takeaway message is even if you have assets, the law allows you to move those assets around and get help. Why? Because we want to be able to make the kids get more money. No, because Medicaid doesn't pay for everything. And we want to make sure that we get every resource available. And then if I still have money, then I can use my money to help pay for extra care, right? How about an extra caregiver that comes in? How about a private room at a skilled nursing? How about my spouse is not become destitute? These are all social goals. Our society has set up as policy goals. So that's why we have all these rules. If you have a loved one who's going in skilled nursing, please do not think that you have to spend it all before you can get help. That is not what the law says. That is just the quick soundbite. There are lots of ways to qualify and get the help, pay for that medical bill.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please subscribe to this channel if you've not already done so, and please leave a review if you found this content to be helpful.